morning. So the Buddha holds up a flower, the gateless gate, K6. The case. Once in ancient times, when the world honored one, was at Mount Gudakutra, or Vulture Peak, he held up a flower, twirled it, and showed it to the assembly. At this, they all remained silent. Only Venerable Mahakashyapa broke into a smile. The world honored one said, "I have the eye treasury of the true Dharma, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, the subtle gate of the Dharma. It does not depend on letters, as being specially transmitted outside all teachings. Now I entrust Mahakashyapa with this." Mumon's commentary. The golden-faced Gautama insolently suppressed noble people and made them lowly. He sells dog flesh under the label of sheep's head. I thought there should be something of particular merit in it. If, at the time, however, all those attending had smiled, how would the eye treasury of the true Dharma have been transmitted? Or, if Kashyapa had not smiled, how would it have been? How would he have been entrusted with it? If you say that the treasury of the true Dharma eye can be transmitted, then that is as if the golden-faced old man is swindling country people at the town gate. If you say it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha say he entrusted only Kashyapa with it? The verse. In handling a flower, the tail of the snake manifests itself. Kashyapa breaks into a smile. Nobody on earth or in heaven knows what to do. Is that nice? Mm-hmm. Holds up a flower. It would be nice if it was that simple, wouldn't it? There's a few of you smiling. You got it. Those of you who didn't smile, lighten up. So, this session, it's special in the sense that it's the Buddha's enlightenment retreat session. It's also the session in which Shinko receives the certificate of independence, or Inca. This is a Rinzai thing. It's not from the Soto school. To be a Roshi in the Soto school, basically, you've had to practice for 10 or 15 years and be over the age of 52. So just hang in there and you're good. The word Roshi, which is the title that you get, is the same Ro as in Rohatsu, which is like December, or the older stage. She is person. But it also has connotations of old and useless. It's your job to make him useless, basically. You know, he's still too useful at this point. But wherever you can, make him useless. Take over things, do things, do that for him. He'll want to do all kinds of things, but don't let him take that over. So Maizumi Roshi, when he passed on the certificate of Inca to Tetsugen, one of the parts that has stayed with me since that time was a beautiful line. Maizumi Roshi said, To complete or not to complete is of no concern. Play freely in self-fulfilling samadhi. And you can take that however you want. To complete or not to complete. You don't have to wait for completion. You know? Completion is an idea. I remember when, you know, I thought, well, I'll never be like the Buddha. And the point is, you don't have to be like the Buddha. The Japanese have a saying which is Shakyamuni Buddha is only halfway there, or Shakyamuni Buddha is practicing with us today. That's one of the things that we talk about in Rohatsu. He wasn't done. Why wasn't he done? I mean, a lot of people think he was, and there never will be anyone like him, but why wasn't he done?
He was still living.
Well, I mean, he's dead now.
Oh, okay.
Why isn't he done? Now, he's kind of interesting. He said, all beings, the phrase that he came out with when he realized, said, all beings, myself, the great earth, are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. And then he put in the kicker, or most people's escape clause, which is, but because of our upside down views, we fail to see it. Those upside down views are when I become, when circumstances are better, you know, when people start treating me with a bit more respect, then. But that then never comes. You know. Then seeing that he was in the same boat as everybody else, this is where we get the arising of the so-called Mahayana school of Buddhism, which was also core to the Buddha's teaching, believe it or not. We're all included in that. He wanted a practice to relieve suffering. In his lifetime, was suffering relieved? No, he wasn't relieved. He also, at the time of his enlightenment, said, I don't know if anybody will be able to do this. I don't know. I really don't. So I might as well just sit here. And then, you know, they say Indra came down, or more likely the bigger part of himself came down and said, well, wait a minute, try. You know, people will pick it up one way or another, but it does, you know, you don't have to have a vision about it, just try. So he started to do that. Why did he do that? I mean, basically he invited a lot of trouble. Could have been pretty easy for himself. When I became abbot of Yokoji, Maizumi Roshi's brother, Takeshi, gave me some advice. I didn't ask for it. And he said, Tenshin, the more you do, the more trouble there is. So there's the Buddha, you know. Similar position, but there's nobody telling him that. But, you see, the thing is, with realization is you realize that we're all in this together. We're all alive together. This is our life. If there's suffering, I feel it. If you suffer, I feel it. And the more that I practice as a human being, the more I see it is difficult to assign suffering. Is this mine or yours? The lines are kind of, they're somewhat blurry. Suffering's a universal thing when it's experienced. Was the Buddha done? No, he wasn't done. After 40 years of practice, he died of dysentery by the side of the road. And entrusted his teachings to his disciples, mainly Mahakasyapa. Why? Because the work wasn't done. What was that entrusting? It wasn't, well, you know, Mark Ashapa's got a really good understanding. You know, he knows the depths of things. You know, just that. You know, and he could stand back and watch. I mean, you have to remember that Mark Ashapa was called Maha, the Great, because even when he came to the Buddha, he had over 500 students. And yet, he saw there was something to learn there. So he started to learn with somebody who had something to teach him. I'm the same way. If somebody has something to teach me, I'll learn. You know, I don't need to put a barrier up. Well, I've got enough now. That's, you know, I don't need to learn that. Somebody has something to teach, I don't care what it is, I'll learn it. Because that's just who I am. You know, the Buddha was the same way. Now, we talk about a case like this where the Buddha holds up a flower. Most people forget about the context of this. I mean, would you give transmission to someone or certification to teach to someone just because they smiled when you raised up a flower? Would you? Come on. No. I mean, Mumon says, suppose everybody had smiled. What would you do? Yeah. So there's a context there. So, and the main context of this is that the Buddha knew Mahakasyapa. And he basically had seen him through many different, say, you could say incarnations, you know, so as a happy person, as a sad person, as a grateful person, as an angry person. He'd seen him in many different ways. He'd seen him help, he'd seen him hinder, he'd seen all kinds of things. I mean, Mark Ashapa wasn't, you know, like a clean-cut guy. You know, he never had a bath. Never washed his clothes. He was ragged. You know, and he used to sit next to the Buddha. You know, there's some character right there. And yet, the Buddha always knew that Mark Ashapa could be relied on. At Mountain Center, when Shinko was there training, he trained with me and I trained with him. It's always a two-way street for 10, 12 years, something like that, if you include a bit at ZCLA. He was always there. He was always reliable. You know, I could always rely on him. A little bit shaky at the beginning. You know, snowed one day and they wanted to go off skiing. He has a different story to this, but you know, I think the story's good, you know, whether you believe it or not. And the time when he was officiating and his underwear fell off in the middle of service. I missed that part. But whenever there was something that really needed to be done, I could always rely on him. But I had students, you know, that there was one in particular that felt that they'd studied for a long period of time, and their understanding of the Dharma was far deeper than his, and that they should be teaching. But they were never there to do the work. They never showed up when they were needed. They only showed up when it was time for the teaching. You know? So it's like with ceremonies. For instance, the ceremony begins with the setup and ends up when everything's put away. The ceremony is the cream in the middle. It's like the cream in the Oreo. But does that work? Session is the cream. The setup, all of the planning, all of the work that needs to be done is the major part of session. And so is the cleanup. It doesn't end with session. If you want to understand daily life, is understand the beginnings and the ends and what happens after. The punctuations are just punctuations, like Inca, certification to teach. These things are just punctuations. The work is done on a momentary basis. That's daily life in itself. That's our, you know, our basic awareness functioning 24/7. The practice of that basic awareness. When it's seen that that is done, as in Mahakashyapa, yeah, the dude can smile. Great. You know, but there's a deeper context. You know, he's always there. He's always reliable. Doesn't need to be patted on the back or rewarded with something. It's like for myself is I finished Cohen's study with Maizu Miroshi probably at age 36, something like that, and I was done. Literally, I was done. I didn't need anything else. That was it. And when I say finished Cohen's study, I'd had the realization for myself that I needed, and I'd gone as far as I needed to go. I didn't need anything else beyond that. I'd fulfilled my own inner question by that time. The titles really didn't do anything for me, you know. Seriously, they didn't do anything for me. But they open a context for teaching, which is helpful in that way. They gain a sort of level of trust. They also gain a standard that has been matched historically. So now if you look at this transmission of Inca in the Rinzai school, they don't have Dharma transmission. Inca is their Dharma transmission, but the way that it's done is the standard is a little bit higher there, say, than a standard Dharma transmission. Maizumi Roshi would add Inca on top of Dharma transmission so that he could see how a teacher did over a period of, you know, in Tetsugan's case, it was probably about 15, 20 years. To see how they really do, see if they can really screw up royally or not, you know. And he would say, I remember him saying to me, you know, I was just talking about how do you regard Inca, and he said, it just helps me keep my hooks in them a bit longer. He would say, see how they do, to keep up that standard. And that standard's important. You know, in Zen nowadays, you know, especially in the US, is that people really mistake Zen for practice for health and well-being. It's a matter of just relieving stress. That's a great thing for many people. It's a really good thing, don't get me wrong. But it goes a lot deeper. You know, we talk about five kinds of Zen in the Zen tradition. The second one then is Zen for... You know, they call it supernatural means or concentration. So you can develop very deep concentration to put into all kinds of sports, martial arts, intensive, you know, extreme sports, that kind of stuff. And then beyond that, you can have the first sort of practice, which is aimed at realization, really realizing one's own nature. You know, the first two, in many ways, are a bit easier to achieve. This one for enlightenment, which is usually regarded as synonymous with the Theravada school, is possible for human beings. The next one is practicing together for realization. You know, we practice together. We support one another. We carry each other along. When one person's up, maybe another one's down, we help each other, you know, along the way. Sangha is a beautiful thing. And then the so-called supreme one is Japanese called Saijojo Zen, which is we practice because we're enlightened. Sounds good, eh? Practice because we're enlightened. What other world could there be? You know? Practice because we're enlightened. This is life. This is our context. This is, you can put the highfalutin words like nirvana on it if you wish. You know, this is undivided. I've known one person that practiced in that way, you know, right from the beginning. And she was, she went off to study in Japan. She had that when she was in America. Became a very good teacher. You know, just realized that this is the enlightened life. First it was the life of a monk, and then it was life in itself. She went off, became a very good teacher in Brazil. You know, this is the enlightened life. If you have that kind of faith, that's an amazing thing. You know, you don't split yourself up when I become, but you know, how can I reveal this? How can I make this occur? Again, this is the transmission. Whether we like it or not, is that this transmission is occurring on a momentary basis, as the sound of the birds, the light, the feeling of the ground. You know, this is going on all the time. But again, our problem is our distancing, putting ourselves in another place and another time. So Mahakasyapa smiles, and quite often the Buddha would walk off and let Mahakasyapa speak, let him talk, because he was a very good speaker. He would let him do those things. Now, this is another thing which is very important, is the Buddha was an apprentice teacher. He wasn't a speaker. We say that he didn't speak a lot in his life. He actually practiced realization. That's what he did. He sat with everybody. Every day he went out. He looked for food, begged for food. When the food was run out in that one area, he'd move off elsewhere. He didn't want to also put too much strain on the people that he was teaching. And then later on, he built they donated a place that he could actually sit permanently. But every day, he sat with everybody else. And nowadays, you have these new age teachers. Well, you know, I'm enlightened. I've done all the sitting I need to do. So, you know, I'll just talk and do that. But there's something that doesn't really rub off there. You know, there's a class system begins to develop. Now, with an apprentice system, which is more the Zen tradition, is that you learn from people just by working together in many different ways. You see how people are in all kinds of different scenarios, etc. And then you see their character really raise up. You see, you know, you see them in, you know, when they're good, bad, indifferent, or whatever. And you know you can trust them. And you know what you can't trust in that process. So remember that as you practice. You know, everything is important that you do. You know, whether it's eating, working, or whatever, is allow the awareness of your own life or whatever it is that you're doing come to this forefront, or everyday life will never be actualized. The practice of everyday life will never be actualized. Definitely don't say to yourself, I can only achieve it on the cushion. You know? I remember you know, many people would think that Zen teachers only exist inside Zendos and giving talks, etc. And people would come to ZCLA, and we'd be out working in the yard, and my Zumi Roshi would have his hat on, and it said "I'm retired" on it, and they would think there's the Japanese gardener, and they would come up and say, "Can you teach me something? Can somebody teach me something about Zen?" And he would just point up to the office, which was upstairs in a little house, you know, on a street. And they would happily go off, and they would go upstairs, and, you know, almost invariably, a few minutes later, you'd see the office manager come over and stick her head out the window and be pointing down there. And this red-faced person going, "Oh, I had the chance to talk with the Zen master, but I didn't." You know, I thought that Zen masters didn't look like that. You know, you never know. Next time you're in the new world, just down the road, getting your cookies, your biscuits, the person right there is may be expounding some wisdom that may turn your life around. You know, you never know with these things. That transmission may occur from anywhere. From your wife, your girlfriend, your son, your daughter. I remember once I was with one of my stepsons, and he was playing, and the stick he had was suddenly a machine gun. And I was saying, wow, it's amazing how that stick can transform into a machine gun. And he goes, it doesn't transform. He says that doesn't transform. You know, it is what it is. Life is what it is. Don't look for something supernatural. Look in the natural places of your own experience of what occurs on a momentary basis. And then these things occur. Transmission occurred for me when I was going around with Shishin Roshi just before his Dharma transmission. We were going around to all of the altars offering incense, and I was just walking and I was going, just this is it. You know, how come I haven't seen this before? Just this is it. I'm just walking around. Just walking through the gravel behind, by the demolished shed, behind Maizumi Roshi's house. Practice realization, this realization, it occurs. Don't practice realization, practice your fantasies, that's what occurs. It never will happen. Has to be, if not me, who? If not now, when? That was a big lesson that Dogen learned. That was his transmission. Where he goes all the way to China to learn about the Dharma. He runs into this Tenzo from a big monastery. The Tenzo is off gathering food for the next day's meal. It's a big monastery. And he's pretty busy, you know. It's not like you would imagine a monk, you know. You usually imagine him being serene and, you know, walking, you know, around, stuff like that. But he's busy, he's haggling with the mushroom vendors and various things, and Dogen's going, who are you? You know, I'm kind of busy, you know. Where do you come from? Oh, I come from Juching's monastery just down the street, you know. But I've got to be back there to cook the meal. And he's like, well, can you teach me about the Dharma? I'm a foreigner, I've just come from... Yeah, I know you're a foreigner, I can tell. You know, and, you know, the conversation goes on. Well, come and visit me. And so he goes there and he arrives. And he goes, he sees the old cook in the courtyard drying out mushrooms, not wearing a hat. You know, it's like New Zealand. You have to wear a hat if you've been out there for 5 or 10 minutes. No, getting there. And he's there, and Dogen goes, you know, you're a person of such wisdom. Why don't you get someone else to do it? And he goes, if not me, who? If not now, when? You know. I mean, that's a really good lesson for our own society. Something needs to be done, do it. Don't rely on someone else to do it. Not me, who, if not now, when? The core of practice right there. You know, if you, there's a beautiful koan, and I think I might have mentioned it yesterday. This is one of my favorites, and it haunts me. It goes, basically, if you want to be a person of suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. Seeing as though you're already such a person, why worry about such a thing? You don't even need the last part, because if you want to be a person of suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. Now, in our rational minds, we think that the shortest distance between two places is a straight line, right? So, here I am, I'm deluded, I'm going over there, because that's enlightenment over there. So I've got to make that motion. Dogen's a little bit different. This person, I think it was Don Dohi in our lineage, he says, if you want to be a person of suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. Cut out the distance. Be that. Now. Swallow it whole. If you want that to occur, if you want to be realized, start to recognize that much and practice that much. Don't have it, don't wait for it. Because that develops the mind of a hungry ghost. It's nice that you put that in the dedication. It's never enough. Even though this universe is like this, we have all of the senses that the Buddha had. Still, there is a desire to be elsewhere, to be distant from our own home. You know, if you are worried about not being at home, make the place that you stand your home. Then everywhere that you go will be home. No matter where you go, here you are. Practice is always in this place. Again, it's you don't have to feel a certain way. It's not about just peak experiences. When I had this great realization, everything dropped off. Great. Now it's like this. How can you really be at home in your own skin? That's an amazing thing. Don't think that enlightenment looks like something. The Buddha died of dysentery by the side of the road. It's a good reward for being enlightened, isn't it? After many years of service, one of the early pioneers in Los Angeles, can you give me a name? Do you remember that pioneer that used to live in Little Tokyo?
Oh, not Sanchaku. Warm Feet Kohei.
I mean, hardly anybody came to see him. And then Maizumi Roshi would go and see him every now and then, a bit later on. Amazing teacher. You know, his writing's very down to earth, very, very good. It doesn't mean that there's a reward for enlightenment, or it looks like something. You know, enlightenment is like this. Well, if you want something else, you know, then better create it. Better do something with it. Yeah. I am the treasury of the true Dharma I, this marvelous mind of Nirvana. Now I entrust it to you. I mean, if you can swallow it, you can. If you can't, then you can't. But then the work is how to do that. Sounds better in Japanese, though. Shobo genzo ne han myo shin. Treasury of the true Dharma. Treasury. Boundless wealth. A place where wealth is kept. Dharma. Truth. I. The thing that perceives, sees these things. This treasury. Each one of us has that. If you take it away from the highfalutin language, we all have that. We all have this entire universe. And then if there is and yet, then there's the problem. This marvelous mind of Nirvana. Or, if you don't want to use nirvana, peace is good enough. This marvelous mind of peace. That much you know peace, practice it. When you're in difficult situations, be at peace with the situation and act in accord with that peace. That much peace lives. It's a practice. It's not a result. You know? And you know, again, is that don't just use the Buddha as an example. You know, in his own life, is that because he was a great teacher, most of his family followed him, his cousins, his half-brothers, his auntie who raised him. They all followed him. And you know what happened? His country was conquered by his mother's country and destroyed. You know, how can you be at peace with that? One of the things that he did was he did the best that he possibly could to make peace, but it wasn't possible. He had to live with that. You know, unlike us in our lives, we have those things. So don't expect it to look like something. That much you know it, apply it. Even if it's like trying to chew glass, do it. And in that process, then, that resolve becomes strong. That's why, you know, in the last 10 years or so, Shinko showed up with Claudia to sit and to practice, because it's valued, that treasury of the true Dharma I, the marvelous mind of Nirvana. Sometimes it looks like they're just offering sitting. No? But that sitting is a window. It's like Dogen says, it is the gate. Sitting is the gate. At back in LA, we have Universal Studios. And in Universal Studios, there's the Psycho House. And if you go to the, you know where the movie Psycho is, though. If you go to the Psycho House, You open the door and you think there's going to be a house inside. But when you look out there, the entire lot is there. The whole universe is behind it. That's what Zazen is. It's a gate. You practice it, then the universe begins to show up. Then it's not just a matter of sitting, it's whatever you do, whether you're working or whatever. The actualization of reality, the practice of reality, as Dogen says, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, peace. You can be at peace with what you do. At any time, you can stop me here and just, if you want to ask any questions or get some more context, please do. Now, in terms of this Rinzai lineage, most people know that Maizumi Roshi had three lineages. So there was the lineage of his father, that's the Soto school, straight Soto school. His father was one of the most hard-working and probably most famous priests of his day. He brought a temple from being nothing to being the biggest in that area of Japan, just north of Tokyo. The second lineage was through Yasutani Roshi, so that was the Yasutani Harada line. That was also Eiken Roshi is through that lineage. Our Kinhin pattern comes from the Yasutani Harada school. So a mixture of slow Kinhin, straight Soto, and the faster Kinhin, Rinzai school. So that's what we do. And also for Westerners, gives us more stretch in that. Now the lineage in that one, a lot of people would say that our Inca lineage comes from that school, but there's a bit of doubt about Harada Roshi's Inca. They say that in the Rinzai school, a few Rinzai teachers that I've talked to in Japan say that he was actually just given what's known as a certification of Kensho. So there's a difference there. So he had deep realization. Now, having said that, people like Soen Roshi, who was the abbot of Ryotakeji at the time, and also the Dharma cousin of Koryu Roshi, used to go and study with him. So you can say Inca is something or nothing. It doesn't make much difference. But the important thing was he was a very powerful teacher. But our true lineage, one that is beyond a doubt in terms of the Rinzai school, is through Koryu Roshi. Now, the way that Koryu Roshi's lineage affects us today is, for instance, when Maizumi Roshi had become a priest at 11, he was sent to Tokyo when he was 16 or 17, and he went to university at I think it was Komazawa University, the Soto School University. But at that point, he was told that he had to study with Koryu Roshi, koans. So he was sent to do it, and apparently he wasn't that fond of it at that point. I mean, you may not find this interesting, but I do. So he studied with Koryu Roshi for this period of time. Now Koryu Roshi had connections with Maizumi Roshi's family. Maizumi Roshi's family was, his mother was the daughter of a Rinzai priest, born near a town of Mishima, where the Fuji Hanya Dojo was, where Koryu Roshi lived and practiced part of the time. So there was a connection there. They knew Joko Roshi, Koryu Roshi's teacher. And so they developed and continued this connection. So he went and did sessions, all kinds of study, lived at the Hanyu Dojo for somewhere between 2 and 4 years. When he was there, he wasn't allowed to wear his robes. He practices as a lay person. That's why we are like this, that appreciation for lay practice. It doesn't matter whether you're a monk or a layperson. The important thing is your sincere desire to practice. It's not how you look. Being a monk is not going to save you. You know, being a monk is an opportunity to serve, to practice, to be of service. You know, so you've got that going for you. You can do that as a layperson. So at the end of that period, he, you know, when he was about 26, he came over to the States. Halfway through that period of time, he raised a whole bunch of money to build a zendo at Zenshuji, the temple in Little Tokyo. And then the bishop, who was in charge of the Soto school in North America, used all the money to do a Sunday school. So he left. He left in a huff and went off and started his own training center. And at the same time, he ran into Kori Roshi. Soen Roshi. It's getting a bit complex. But Soen Roshi says, well, why don't you finish your studies with Kori Roshi? And in the meantime, I know this friend, Yasutani Roshi. So he finished his studies with those two, and the lineage has come down to us today. We're very fortunate in having these various flavors, because it tends to open us up to different approaches. Again, Zen practice, even in Japan, is not monolithic. You know, you look at training in Japan. Sometimes it's very formal. Like at a Heiji, sometimes it has got more of the sense of cultivated casualness, which is the ambience of, say, Sojiji. We're from the Sojiji lineage in terms of our what we do here. This is the transmission. This is part of what we do. It's good to know where these things come from. The interesting thing with that kind of approach is you just watch. And you see how things are done, and you copy. You know? Just like in carpentry, you watch, you see how things are done, and you copy. And then you develop your own style. When you hold that, when you can stay true to that, then the transmission occurs. In Japan, you can become a sensei in 2 or 3 years. With my Zumi Roshi, about 10. What was that? What's all that about? It was standard. You needed to be able to study. You needed to be able to practice. You need to have a good realization. Understanding and realization were separated. Understanding can be a good understanding of a text, of Buddhism. But Maizumi Roshi wanted the true understanding, which was to stand under, to experience. Because experience is always far deeper, and that's what he would call realization, to make real. When the practice is living now, then you praise the ancestors and the Buddhas. To copy them, you insult them. To realize is to make it your own. And that's what he wanted, you know. No matter how, you know, down home and country-like our practice is, it's authentic, genuine. Shinko embodies that. He won't give you any bullshit, unless he's messing with you. You know, so he's trusted on that level. You know, This treasury of the true Dharma eye, you know, is a local. It's from Wellington, you know. Does lots of things that you do. If you're an Indian, the Buddha would have been like that too. If you're like Maizumi Roshi, you know, it's the same thing. He was a character. You know, don't just look at that. See how somebody functions. Really go in there, find out. Find out about that person, see them wholly. Then you can say something about it. You know, Shinko was telling me, he said, he went to Japan, and this guy in all earnestness said, oh, I know that tension. He saw the centre and ran off with his girlfriend. And that was the truth. His truth. You know? Isn't that great? So, you know, it's just like with this practice. With this practice, you know, it's like a book. Yeah, read the title, I've got that. Now I know what it is. Or you can then speed read the book, you know, go through it really quick, get the pertinent points. Or you can read it and immerse yourself in the characters. Really get lost in those characters. Identify with them, cry with them, smile with them. Just like in practice. Don't stand back and observe. Be that. Be the screwed upness. There's great stories that come from things that we regard as delusion. So Myoyu comes to bring her family to see the great teacher, Maizumi Roshi. Maizumi Roshi's blind drunk in a bush. And they go, "That's the gardener." Part of his character, you know. It's not a matter of deifying somebody. Part of his character. Somebody does something wrong, and man, the roasting he could give you. You know, part of his character. You can't put it all in one box in that way. But when you know somebody over a period of time, you know their heart. People criticize Genpo Roshi, who's my Inca teacher. You know, but sometimes when I was crying for enlightenment, doing the best I could, and yet still nothing would happen, he was the only one that came over and bought me pizza. You know, who cared enough? You know, you get to know a person's character. That's far more important. It's far deeper than some observation over the surface from distance. That's why a lot of people don't want to study with a real teacher. Because they're dangerous. Yeah.
Yes, when you hear a monk is blind drunk or something similar. Mm-hmm.
I don't condone it, but sometimes that occurs.
How does that fit with the precepts of it?
Yeah, how does it fit with the precepts? You know, how does it fit? I'll give you another context. So, Sungsunin, a good friend of Maizumi Roshi, is at Providence, and he says, you guys go ahead. I'm gonna come and teach when the talk begins. He's gonna be sitting beforehand, so they're all waiting for him. He doesn't show up. Then he doesn't show up for the talk. So they get worried and they go looking for him. And Sungsunim is out in the on a vacant lot by an oil drum with a bunch of tires and stuff burning in it, drinking with the bums. And they're saying, "Well, why don't you come to the Dharma talk? You should be preaching the Dharma." He goes, "I'm preaching the Dharma." Now that's a different context. He didn't drink, so that's a that's a difference. Now, can you also appreciate somebody's weakness and not just put yourself in a moral position and go see what they do in their life and know that that's a weakness? Knowing that you don't have to exhibit that weakness. Because I studied with Maizumi Roshi, I didn't get transmission in alcoholism. And I have no right to criticize him. I don't have a right to condone what he does either. But he's dead. And so I let him have his time in the Pure Land.
I was going to just share another story, if mm-hmm. I could, about, because of the lack of access that I have living in Gisborne right now, mm-hmm. I've been checking out some online sanghas. And there was one by an American man in Japan who's a sensei.
Yeah.
Or calls himself such. And there was a couple of people that were watching it, watching one of his Dharma talks, or mm-hmm. watching him meditate, and called him on the fact that he was wearing earphones during the thing, and he said he wasn't. And they actually went back and looked at the video and blew it up and so proved that he was.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe how can you have? I mean, that goes beyond.
Yeah.
A peccadillo like, you know, drinking.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of, you know, judging a person's character.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, the thing is that if you trust a person enough, then study with them. If you don't trust yourself to study with someone because of certain behaviors, then don't. You know, it's really in your hands. I mean, I can criticize anybody, any teacher. I know a lot of them. But the thing is, if I do that, I've got to criticize this one. I have my own pulse, my ways that I approach things. You know, things that I've worked on for many years. But that's, you know, that's what I do. I work on those. You know. I mean, I have great admiration for Trungpa Rinpoche. His teachings were amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, but I didn't know him that well. But I can't, you know, I can praise what he did. I also can criticize what he did, you know. But I didn't have his you know, his ingredients.
I think it's good. What do you say with Jimmy Rushi? That was a weakness, because the problem with Trump, I like Trump a lot too. The problem is that Trump has students explaining away his crazy wisdom when there's lots of really good examples of.
If you can see it that way,
Wow, I don't. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, I think it was abusive a lot of the time, not crazy wisdom. It was just.
Yeah, and you're the one that's got to be able to differentiate in that, you know. You know, there's a lot. If he doesn't feel right, probably isn't. But, you know, with all of this, it's important to be able to say something. Don't just stuff it or leave. You know, just try and say something, because you might be able to change that situation, that circumstance.
And also not to dismiss Trungpa entirely because of that.
Well, why would you?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, some people do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's many things. Is one of them that tends to get overlooked is the fact that, like, personally, I learn a lot from doing things wrong. I learn probably about as much from doing wrong as doing so-called right. And it doesn't mean that I have to do that wrong either. Is I can see somebody else doing it and learn from it. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, simply because somebody behaves that way, you have to copy him to be something. I remember, say, with my Jimmy Roshi, we were at this symposium called Harmonia Mundi in the late 80s, early 90s. And there's all of these sort of teachers and gurus, including the Dalai Lama, that came. And they did a panel. My Jimmy Roshi was on this panel. And there was one thing that really stood out about him, and especially one phrase. They asked this panel, you know, these odd questions, like, if you could be anybody in history, who would you be? My Jimmy Roshi immediately stands up and goes, nobody, nowhere. Now you may think, well, you know, like the what was it, the Sufi guy stands up, Lex Hickson, and he goes, well, he's a Zen master, he can say that, you know. But the thing is, that's a beautiful thing. If you are nobody, nowhere, you're not contingent on circumstances or whatever. That's what my life is at its root. You know, as soon as I start to define myself, then problems start to come in. So if I define myself as a United fan and they lose, I'm in trouble. You know. You know, or something changes, I'm in trouble. So far better to be no one in no place until I need to be someone in some place, like a father, a son, and hold this position. You know, but most of the time I don't need to define myself in that way, because it causes trouble. It just makes me suffer. this is your opportunity.
So I got one question, another question.
Yeah.
I'm 61 years old, right?
Yeah.
Am I too old to try and find a teacher now?
No, I'm 61 too.
But you've already been through all of the...
Well, I mean, just look around you. There's plenty of teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So don't distance it to start off with.
Okay.
The other thing is just realistically look at what's possible for you to do
mm-hmm.
in that way. You have to look far. You know, and the thing is, like, for me, when I started, there were, I started in England when there was no transmitted teachers there. There was Irmgard Schlogel, who got a lot of experience in a Daitokuji temple, but wasn't transmitted as an independent teacher. And then there was people at Throstle Hall. So I went up there and I learned what I could learn. And in that process, I had to learn the difference between shit and shinola. You know, which is a very good thing to do, is that learning and seeing what's true and not true is very important. You know, you don't have to be, you know, rude about it or anything. It's just learn what you can learn. And it's the same with me. It's when a person feels like they've learned enough, go off and study with somebody else. You know, but start locally. You know, look at the people. I mean, Shinko's got a really good background. Not only background, but understanding and realization. And, you know, the main thing that any teacher has to do is show up. You know, that's overlooked over and over, you know. Teachers are not a teacher if they're not there showing up. What can they teach? You know, talking when it's convenient. If practice is about when it's convenient, you know, that's not much use. And I have seen him teach when he's pissed off, or when he's, you know, he's struggling, he's sad, you know, all of these things, he still shows up. You know, I can't say that for many teachers. You know, so there's that. The next thing is on a personal level, it's important to be able to ask those questions that are buried, bring them to the surface, and then to be able to receive. Even from somebody who's younger. I teach some people who are older. I'm 61 myself, and I have a couple of students that are, you know, 71. One of them who's just finished being the head trainee at the place, and I learn from them. But they've got to be able to learn from somebody younger as well, yeah. You know. I remember with Master Joshu, there was... Before he went on pilgrimage when he was about 60, he said... Well, you know, I think I'll go around and I'll look at how the teaching is. And if I have something to teach, then I'll teach, you know, a person of 80. He said that, a man of 80. And if a young girl of 5 or 6 has got something to teach me, then I'll learn. If you have that kind of openness, you'll learn from anyone, anywhere. And that is the core of it. Things like Dogsan and interviews are there so that you learn to live your life like you're in Dogsan. I learned that from a Korean teacher, actually. George Bowman, who's another character. You know? You learn it anywhere. These things is that you raise the value of it. That's why we have the Buddha on an altar. It's not because we're worshipping the old dead dude. You know, it's to raise up that vast, empty, unwritten aspect. So that's what it is, you know. People say, well, why do you bow to the Buddha? I don't bow to the Buddha, you know. I bow to my true nature over and over. That's another thing, you know, in terms of our lineage. Somebody asked Kori Roshi and I think Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, who is the one who said the immortal words to the Japanese, or gave the Japanese the immortal words, let the emperor be like the sun And as a people, we must learn to bear the unbearable so that they could surrender at the end of World War II. He asked him what was the core of the precepts, or captain praises. And Yamamoto Genpo Roshi said, the one that wrote said those words, said, I only drink the best. I only drink the best. This is the best. I only drink the best. Wherever he is, I only drink the best. Apparently he did only drink the best as well. But the other one was Koryu Roshi. He asked Koryu Roshi, this capping phrase for the precepts. He said, I only bow to myself. And he wasn't being arrogant in that. Is that, you know, there's that bowing really is that acknowledgement of unity. And it also takes a little bit more to get your head down on the ground, you know. You're actually doing something about it. And over a period of time you actually actualize it. It's like doing the four vows is you know, after doing it for 10 or 15 years, it actually means something. Not just mouthing a few songs. So anyway, in terms of teaching, start locally. Do that. If something's not being realized for you, go elsewhere. Yeah.
I had a question. You as an answer to a comment, you said that, you know, if something doesn't feel right, it perhaps isn't.
Yeah.
But I, you know, have limited trust in myself.
Yeah.
Well, I may be cherry picking what just suits me. I may not understand.
Well, in, you know, you've got to find that out through experience. That kind of thing comes through experience. You learn what you can trust, and you learn what you've got to be suspicious of. And that's by studying closely your own life, seeing how things work. And eventually, you know, you see what you can trust in. Being, you can always trust in. If something seems a bit fishy, look into it more and see if it really is. And if it is, then most likely it is that way. If you need to get more information from that, know the questions to ask. That's a real important thing in terms of practice. The Japanese have another statement that I like, and you know, which is, to be a good student, you have to be a good thief. Mm. So, it's like for myself, is I would nonchalantly just go along with my Izumi Roshi, and I would learn. I would find times when I could do that, you know. I wouldn't just avoid him because, you know, sometimes he could be harsh. You know, and the teachings would arise just out of daily life. They weren't, you know, a lot of people think Zen's curricula. Well, now I've got this, gone through 200 koans, and now I'm a Dharma holder, and you know, etc., etc. It's not curricula. You know, it's that things arise out of one's daily life at a center, for instance, or if. It's more likely to happen if you go to the center and get involved. You see these teachings arise, you see how people behave, you know, you see the positives, the negatives, all kinds of stuff comes up. It's like when I come to the mountain, I always tell people is that, you know, the mountain is the biggest teacher here, it's not me. I'm very fortunate, I don't have to do much, the mountain does it. You know, wow, we better clear the roads today. You know, while I was away, I was emailing Jokai, who is my successor that's running the center, and he goes, yeah, there was, like, we thought it was a big earthquake last night, but two trees came down and almost took the house out, you know. So what's the great teaching of the Dharma with that? You know, cut them out of the way, limb them, cut them up, get them out of the way, you know. That's the next thing to do. The teachings arise in that way. But most people can't take that. You get these people, you know, you have brilliant minds. And they go, teach me. You know, and I meant to go, well, the Buddha said, in 2000 years BC, he said, all beings have the wisdom and virtue of the awake one to listen. Oh, got that. Tell me something more, you know. rather than, you know, here I am. You know, this is the life of the Buddha.
Kung Fu Panda.
Oh yeah, you see, yeah, he's one of my favorite teachers. Anyone seen Kung Fu Panda?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, Po is this big panda, and he's somehow Oogway, the great Kung Fu master, who's about to pass away, appoints him as the Dragon Warrior, and he's always had this great love for Kung Fu, and he's meeting all of these other Kung Fu warriors who he feels are far better than him. And they go, you know, they're sort of annoyed because they think one of them should get it because of all the work they've done. And so they go up and they go, okay, Kung Po, show us what you've got. He goes, well, I don't know if my Kung Fu will be up to it today because I've just eaten. you know. But it's always now. It's the, however you are, however I am, it's just now. You know, and the funny thing is, the deepest teachings come unconsciously. When you just do what you're doing. People come up to me and they say, remember when you said such and such? I have no idea what you're talking about. You know, there's just living life. People see something that arises out of living. And it strikes you in a certain way. You know? It strikes you. You see somebody's humanity. It's far better than having some intellectual understanding about compassion. You know, so I remember Maizumi Roshi seeing this this young boy who's just in his robes coming out the Zendo all formal, you know, with his efficient stick and keser on. He's walking down the path and he's very intense. And he sees his boy and realizes that this is the boy whose mother's just died. And he comes up to him and he puts his robes around him and, you know, he's crying. You know? Far better than words, you know. We're all having a moment, you know. All coming out. There's all kinds of teachings, you know. Just but be open to those teachings. And then the other thing is just know the difference between shit and shinola. Know what's true and what's not true. You know? If you're in doubt about something, ask about it. Don't assume that it's a certain way. And that's the thing with internal practice too. Ask the question. If it's not clear, that's exactly the place you've got to go to. You know? It's like Trungpa Rinpoche, one of his great sayings was, when I meditate, I go to that which is most difficult. Otherwise, difficulties will come to me. You know. So what is that most difficult place? Master Tozen said, underneath these robes, not knowing who I am, is the most difficult, painful place. If something's not clear, shed light on it. Don't stay in the places, well, you know, now I'm in the pure land, it's all good. You know? If that's the only thing on your mind, that's maybe fine, but if there is dark places, that's the place you've got to look. That is the process of practice. That's why it's endless. You know, and then, you know, the role of a teacher like Shinko is that when he sees one of you going through something, he recognizes it and then maybe will tell you something, maybe show you something. You know, it's like when we sit, we sit together. Whatever arises in Zazen is not necessarily personal, it's dealt with together. We do these things together. That's why it's more fun when people show up. Because then we're a Sangha, we're a community. You know, and the implication of Sangha is a forest. And the forest in the sense that we shade each one another. Big trees, small trees. You know, that's what we do. If we're not doing that, if you're just in it for you, then you know, think about that. You know, it's like the word Dharma too. Dharma comes from the word dri, a three-legged pot, something that's very stable, something you can always rely on. You know, that when you really so-called contact this Dharma, which is your life, that which is always here, where can you go? What can knock you off? So that's the aspect of Dharma. I have the treasury of the true Dharma, that which cannot be knocked off or taken away. And just in the same way with, trying to think of that teacher's name now, Ryokan. The thief comes around, tries to rob his house and sees he's got nothing to rob. So he gives him his robe and then said, I wish I could give him the moon, you know. You know, when you have this, is that you don't need an awful lot. That's enough. You can have a lot, but you don't need an awful lot. Want little, know how to be satisfied, enjoy peace and tranquility, remember who you are, what you got. You know, it's practice. Practice those things, actualize them. Again, for those of you that are have Jukai, is that the raksu that you have is the symbolism behind it is a rice field. That rice field is a place of cultivation. So you practice, you realize, you actualize. So there's a time for planting, there's a time for weeding, there's a time for draining the fields, there's a time for harvesting and enjoying and making the rice wine, and then applying everything that you know back into practice over and over and over, you know, year in, year out. The practice goes on. It's not just a product of my practice. You know, this Tathagata has been going on since beginningless time. We just take this place right now. So, you know, you can relax, it continues, it goes on endlessly. But if you're putting false effort in, trying to get somewhere else, it's going to be painful. But if you put the attention and see what you actually have, appreciate that, do the work that is necessary to maintain this, it's not so difficult. It's when I first started practicing, I thought, oh God, I'm going to be doing this forever. And now it's like, oh God, I'm going to be doing this forever. But there's a difference. That actually is a good story because... I don't know. Just shut me up when I've said too much. But I'm trying to give you a bit of history and connection here. One of the teachers that used to come to Mountain Center was a very good teacher called Yamakawa Sogen Roshi from Shogenji, a major, really tough monastery in Japan. And he was kind of a weak sort of physiologically type guy, and he went off to the monastery, and it's very, very tough, and after a few days there, I realized he wasn't going to survive. And being Japanese, is he couldn't just leave, because not only would he lose face, but the people that promoted him would lose face, and his whole family would lose face. So he came up with this scheme, right? And this scheme is just flawless. He goes, I'm going to do twice as much as everybody else. And then, my body's just going to give up. And I'm just going to pass out. And nobody will lose face. And I can leave. Great strategy. You know, great strategy. So he applies the tactics. He starts carrying two sacks of rice instead of one. And he runs from one place to the other, you know. He sits more than everyone else. You know, at the end, in the traditional Rinzai school, at the end of Zazen, is that the seniors go first, and then the next senior goes 10 minutes after that, and the next senior goes 10 minutes after that. So if you've got a monastery of 25, 30 people, it's like 12 o'clock at night when you leave. And so, at that point, he's going, God, I've only got two hours sleep, kind of thing. And so this goes on for a while. Then after about a week, he's going, I feel stronger. And he goes, wow, I've got 2 hours sleep. His whole attitude changed around. Now, take this as a lesson. Don't take it just as a story. That's a possibility. when you immerse yourself in and you don't give a finite time to your life, you know, I no longer think, well, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. I don't know. If I ever found something better, I would do it. But I can say after 40-some years, I have and trying other things, I have not found anything better than this. For one, it's free. You don't have to go anywhere for it. I mean, it's not that there isn't a cost, you know, but it's free. And again, you don't have to go anywhere because it's this. You know, where are you going to go? Because when I'm there, this is how it is. And then, you know, so all I have to focus on, I'll do my best now, and then that will take care of itself later. I'm serious, you know. Don't think, you know, I remember the first 7-day session I did. I counted every single period that was there. And I was on a count now. Oh, 90 periods to go. And then I would sit in between the periods too, you know. But it's just like, I was making it into a hell, you know. This was a duration of time. So I was defining my life in terms of time. But, you know, again, it's experientially, this is what time is now. It's being. It's not a duration. As soon as I stopped doing that and started to put myself in, to rather than to survive it, but to enjoy it, to appreciate it, to look into the nature of, then it develops its own rhythm and it takes care of itself. You know, if I start to go, well, it is going to be this way, I'm already screwed because I don't know. I have no idea how it's going to be. And the same with practices, that just practice now. Stick your head down. Do it. Don't keep on reflecting, how am I doing now? Is this working for me? No, it's not working, it never works. You work, you do. Or the one who looks through these eyes is the one that does it, if you want to take a load off. You know? And this is, you know, this is practice. You learn to relax in the midst of it. It's not such a big epic thing, it's one thing after another. If you can learn to flow like in session, then your life begins to change. You know, you don't have to go, well, it's going to be like this when I get over there. Who knows? You find out. How are we doing?
Lunchtime.
Lunchtime, okay. Thank you. Saved by the bell.